Welcome to another edition of Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio, and tonight's program is going to sound a bit different as once again we are in remote locations practicing social distancing. So Cliff is at home in Nacogdoches and I'm at home here in Shreveport, and we have Atoy Jones manning the console at the station and Wally Derleth all the way over on the other side of the building in the conference room manning the phones. And we do ask that as you try to call in that you be patient, as Wally Derleth is the only one there and he may have his hands full. We invite you to call in tonight with your questions about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He's also the first author of the book, Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, thanks again for joining us.
Hey, Bill, I'm happy to be here. Wish we could all be in the studio together, but with social distancing, I think this will work. It sure worked out pretty well last month.
It did indeed, and we want to thank Dr. Beverly Burden again for joining us last month for a joint episode. By the way, she will be back next Tuesday night for the next edition of What's Bugging You. Once again, we invite you to call in tonight and ask Cliff your questions about birds at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And if you'd like Cliff to identify a bird tonight for this show, please send them to my email address, wbeckett, that's W-B-E-C-K-E-T-T, at lsus.edu. wbeckett at lsus.edu. Cliff, at the end of last month's program, or I should say March's program, you had a conservation tip for us. So can you refresh our memories as we begin this week's program?
Yeah, for new listeners, we end every episode with a conservation tip. And this one was handing down your old binoculars. They might have a second life. And we're talking about gently used premium optics. We're not talking about old, worn out, or binoculars in need of repair. But there's two national programs which are really good that we mentioned in the March episode. One is American Birding Association's Birders Exchange Program, and the other is the Optics for the Tropics Program. And both of them accept gently used premium binoculars to put into the hands of conservationists and biologists in the Caribbean and Latin America. And so they get a second life. And so if you have a pair like that that's just sitting around, you can go to aba.org or optics for the tropics.com. Optics for the tropics.org and find out how to donate. Another option is if close to home, if you have a nature center or a park, you might go to see if they have a loaner binocular program for visitors, especially when they have school children spending the day at their facility, walking the grounds. They might like to have loaner binoculars as well. So if you do have an old worn out pair or one that needs, you know, that's just dead and not really can be used again, those make a really good bookend on the bookshelf and are great conversation piece. So don't throw them away, put them up on the shelf, and it'll be like an antique item up there on the shelf. So try to give some of these old binoculars a second life, and it would really help out.
All right, and make sure I'm There we go. Now I'm on. I muted my mic for a second and fumbling around with technology here, which is a bit of a pain sometimes. So each month we do a profile species, and we'd like to know what you have for this month's profile species.
Yeah. This month we're going to profile the white-winged dove, and this is the bird that Stevie Nicks, singer from the rock band Fleetwood Mac, sang about in her popular 1981 solo hit called Edge of 17. Some people hearing this bird for the first time think it's some sort of daytime vocalizing owl. Its deep coos somewhat resemble the hoots of an owl. We're not going to listen to Stevie Nicks, but we are going to listen to a real white-winged dove here. For several decades, the white-winged dove has expanded its range northward out of South Texas, especially targeting agricultural areas as well as urban areas, as within the Red River Radio listening area and beyond, including as far away as Canada. To our south, this dove occurs throughout Central America and much of the West Indies. In fact, the adjective Asiatica in its Latin name, Zenaida Asiatica, is an erroneous reference to the Indian subcontinent or East Indies, where this species does not occur, when that adjective should have referred to the West Indies, like Jamaicensis, as in of Jamaica, a country where this bird is a common year-round resident. When compared to the familiar mourning dove, the white-winged dove is a little paler, larger, plumper, and shorter-tailed. And because of its namesake, when flying, the bird shows large white wing patches plus white at the tip of the tail. Even while perched, a sliver of that white wing patch runs visibly down the length of its folded wing. Like the mourning dove, the white-winged dove is a popular game bird across much of its range in the New World. During long flights, the white wing usually flies higher above the ground than most dove and thus is frustratingly out of range of many wing shooters. White wings are fairly omnivorous, but really enjoy seeds and nuts. At backyard seed feeders, they can get into large numbers consuming vast amounts of costly seed. They're often bullies at the feeder, puffing up their chest as they approach smaller birds in order to get dibs on any food. White wings can nest in dense colonies. Some such nesting colonies in Tamaulipas, Mexico have numbered an astounding 400 pairs per acre. To see a photo of a white-winged dove snapped by James Childress, our radio show's trusted wildlife photographer, please visit the bird calls page at redriverradio.org.
And what a fabulous photographer he is, something to aspire to for those of us who have cameras but can't quite get it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All right, Cliff, let's talk a little bit about last month's program. I thought we had a good show, and we certainly relayed quite a bit of useful information for the audience about the role of insects and birds, their both symbiosis and their predatory behavior, because they work together for the better of nature. And they also feed each other in a lot of ways.
That's right. They depend on each other, don't they? Yeah, I wanted to point out that I made a goof. I forgot a few words when we were discussing chitin, spelled C-H-I-T-I-N. I failed to start when I started talking about how it's part of feathers, hair, fingernails, etc. I failed to mention that chitin is something similar to keratin. K-E-R-A-T-I-N. Keratin is what we mammals and birds have that are the basis of all those things I mentioned. And so I didn't mention that last month. I goofed. I went from chitin to feathers and fingernails, and I should have had the word keratin in between. So I wanted to fix that real quick. Thank you.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have lines open right now, and we invite you to call in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we do have our first caller online, and that is Matt. Matt, you're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hi, I have 2 points. First, I'd like to thank you and the Red River listening audience about a question I had about a couple of years ago that you I heard you replay a little bit later about what birds reminded you most of dinosaurs.
Ah, that was a fun one. Yeah, I really remember that one very well, and we got a lot of feedback on that, and that was a lot of fun. Has it been that long, Matt, since we talked about that?
It's been a while. I mean, I guess since that Jurassic World 2 came out, but what you refer to is an amazingly creepy bird.
Yeah, and have you thought more about that topic and thought of anything else to add?
Around here, the grackles that gather in the parking lots of like Walmart and Kroger, those remind me of so much of dinosaurs. I consider throwing out little bits of a cracker and bread to be feeding the dinosaurs.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that was a really thoughtful question that really takes you time to chew on and think about. And so, that one was a really good one. So thanks so much for reminding us about that one.
I do have another question, and maybe you can settle an argument me and a friend have had. Hunting season for the American snipe is year-round, and there's no age limit. Am I correct?
Well, there is snipe hunting that is a joke. And everything you just listed is correct. But unfortunately, there is a real bird called the Wilson snipe. The old name is common snipe. And there is a season, and it's very limited. And so if you're going to do the real snipe hunting, you need to look at the books. Depending on what state you're in, the dates and the bag limits can vary. But the Boy Scout version, urban legend version of snipe hunting is a daily thing. Yes, indeed.
You just gave me a whole new level of detail to get somebody to go snipe hunting. I tell you what.
Yeah. So most of your duck hunters know snipe hunting because the snipe and most of your major duck season, the big season, overlap. And so you'll talk to a lot of hunters who, if you don't know better, you think they're just pulling your leg when they say, well, we went duck hunting and when we got back, we had to walk through this marshy area, this muddy area, and we kicked up some snipe and we collected those too. And you might think, oh yeah, right. But they really did. So that's the problem with snipe, the phrase snipe hunting. There's the real version and the fake version. And so you have to know kind of which one you're talking about. So so we're talking about both, actually, aren't we, Matt?
Oh, right. And I meant to call in when you had the game wardens from Texas and Louisiana in, because I heard you do that on a regular basis, right?
No, that's the only time we've done that, and we probably ought to do it again, maybe every few years. I don't think we'll do that annually because that's asking a lot. The way we did that, we didn't want to have one state warden over another. So we had both Louisiana and Texas, and we had a representative from each agency. And so the rules and regs are different in states, especially with waterfowl, because the Sabine River separates the Central Flyway from the Mississippi Flyway. And so there are different bag limits and seasons and things that are just a little bit different, but enough that if you're a hunter on, say, Toledo Bend or Caddo Lake, you really need to be real careful about where are you and what you're hunting, because if you're on the Texas side or the Louisiana side, could make a big difference.
I had a question. I found a blue heron feather that I just while fishing on the bayou. Brought it home, gave it to somebody. If they don't take it out of their house, you know, that shouldn't be a problem. You're not supposed to take those, any kind of feather. Having a feather was like, you know, contraband.
Well, technically you're not supposed to be in possession of a feather of any kind of a protected species, including the one you listed. So you could have something like a turkey feather or the curlicue on a mallard. You could have that on your hat because those are game birds. And you could argue that, hey, I had a license back then and I shot it legally and I have the feather, but you can't ever say that about a great blue heron or hundreds of other species. So the rule of thumb is don't be in possession of it. Now, we don't have game wardens that knock on people's door and say, I'm going to check your cupboards and your bookshelves for feathers. That's not what's going to happen. But I have been used as an ornithologist to identify body parts of birds, including, and I mentioned this on the show, I believe, before, a game warden pulled up to an intersection in a city here in Texas, and another car pulled up next to him with talons hanging from the rearview mirror inside the car. Just like some people have a pair of dice or jewelry hanging down, well, this guy had raptor talons. So the game warden pulled him over, and I had to identify what species it came from, because it does matter which species it is. Think about it. If it's a bald eagle, it's a lot more serious than most of your other raptors. But person that had them hanging from their car, he claimed, well, I found it dead on the road, and it was just going to waste. But the point with that is you have to let it go to waste. We get a lot of calls from people that want to get that horned owl that's dead on the road. They want it mounted and put in their house. That's a no-no. You're not going to get permission for that. And actually, most taxidermists are going to call the game warden as soon as you leave. If you take something like that to the taxidermist to have done, he's going to have your name and number, and by law, he's going to have to call the game warden and say, look, this guy just came in and brought a great horned owl, and you're going to have to investigate. So the best thing is just leave it be. Another thing game wardens find is at flea markets, people find feathers and they like to put them in maybe floral bouquets that they sell. That's a no-no as well. So just because a feather is there and looks enticing doesn't mean you need to pick it up, and certainly don't need to put it in a floral arrangement that you're going to sell, because you could get in trouble. So again, game wardens aren't going to come to the house and bust you, but they'll find you if you're driving around with talons hanging, if you're going to the flea market selling these bouquets. And so the general rule is not to be in possession of feathers.
Would I be able to ask one more question from you?
Okay.
Do you know anything about the phrase, a feather in your hat?
Well, go ahead. Tell us.
I've always wondered, you know, I mean, it seems like something, you know, I guess Native Americans or something, but, you know, you said, and you used the phrase a feather, you know, you wouldn't put it in a hat. What is with that phrase?
Yeah, I don't know. We could Google that, or maybe another caller would like to come on the air and tell us if they know. But no, I guess unless it's something of an accomplishment, maybe. So I don't know the origin of that term, but that's a good one. Matt, you're leaving us with another thing to think about. I like it.
All right. Well, I do appreciate being able to, you know, call in, and it's a wonderful listening area to be able to be so thoughtful. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Matt.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. Can't say it. And you might want to pause for a moment. We do have three callers online, so give it a few minutes. And we're going to go next to Kathy from Bexville, Texas. Kathy, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Okay. Hi, Cliff. It's nice to be able to talk with you. Well, we live out in the country in Panola County in Texas. And a couple of weeks ago, we saw a couple of roadrunners real close to our house. And as a matter of fact, I was sitting on my screened porch one afternoon, and one of them came right up to the screen door and peered in like he was looking for something. Huh. So we were fascinated by that. And then I heard the calls. I checked online and heard the calls of the male and the female. So we were pretty excited about that because they're so much fun to watch. But in the last couple of weeks, I haven't heard their calls, and I was a little bit worried about them because I have heard that they have trouble because they nest on the ground. They have trouble with the fire ants. And so I wondered if the fact that I haven't heard their calls in the last week or so might mean that they were hurt or they moved on or maybe they don't call when they're nesting. I'm not sure.
Yeah, so there's several things to talk about, and that's a great species. And I just submitted an article to our department magazine that included a little write-up about birds that come to windows and look at their reflection and they think it's an intruder or you know, a competitor, someone that's trying to take their territory. But a lot of people think that the bird's looking in, wanting to come inside the house. So I have a feeling that Roadrunner was seeing his reflection or knew if the screen was open or closed and the door wasn't, maybe he was looking for that reflection against a window. And so that's not a bird wanting to come in, because we've even had people call saying, did anybody lose a Roadrunner? Because he's over here trying to get in my house. When in fact, he just sees his reflection. He's got a pea-sized brain. He hadn't figured it out. And he's attacking it, pecking on the glass. People think, oh, he's tapping, he's knocking, he wants to come in. He's pecking at his reflection. Roadrunner is one of the top birds that does that. Some others are bluebird, northern cardinal, and mockingbird. These are all birds that I mentioned in the article that hopefully will come out in the fall in the magazine. So that's great that you heard one, Kathy. They make a mournful, deep, mournful cooing. Sounds like a dog whimpering sort of in the distance. It's real deep, like a and that's what the Roadrunner sounds like. I think if you don't hear one, if you've been hearing it a while, this is the time of the year where they could be busy tending to their young. So you might not be hearing it because they've got their hands full, so to speak, tending to young, feeding. And as the young get bigger, they require a lot more food. And so the adults are busy feeding. So maybe that's what's going on. But the bottom line is that's such a low density breeding bird in your area that I wouldn't put the blame on fire ants if they disappeared. I would put the blame on, they're just low density and they're sometimes here one moment and gone the next. It's a bird that I take note of whenever I see it driving around, and there are very few places that I see one on the road. Along the roadside that when I return days, weeks, months, years later, that I'll see them again.
Yeah.
So I think they're just wandering around trying to find that special place for raising young. And hopefully they have on your property because they are such a hoot to watch.
Oh, they are. It's really delightful to see them. So, well, I'm glad to think that maybe there's nothing wrong, but they're just taking care of their little ones.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Cliff.
Great. Thank you, Kathy.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist from Red River Radio. And we invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Steve from Bernice, Louisiana. Steve, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
I just wanted to call for two or three reasons. The more I listen, I want to get this out of the way first. I'd be remiss if I did not thank you for turning me on to Oreo feeders. I'm the guy that called in about the what to do to attract red tanagers, scarlet tanagers. And I bought one and put it up. And hung it up, and hummingbird came to it first, but I had four Oreos here a few weeks ago, but they just passed through.
Oh, cool.
And we
that's
don't
neat. That's a lot of color.
But I hadn't seen a tanager yet, but it's a little early for them.
Tanagers are, you know, scarlet tanager has been here for about a month, but they're busy getting insects up in the canopy. They're not as big at getting on the feeder as an oriole. So I wouldn't get my hopes up. I think if you want to see a tanager, plant a mulberry tree. That is the number one best thing for getting scarlet tanagers in migration in our area, or summer tanagers during migration and in the breeding season. But you cannot beat a fruiting mulberry for attracting those. So that's your next homework assignment, Steve, is to plant one.
They're green right now, but we've got a mulberry tree.
Oh, good. Well, then keep an eye on it, because in the coming weeks when those get ripe, you're going to be able to see a summer tanager. They're in the Bernice, Louisiana area, so I wouldn't go anywhere until you find one coming to your mulberries.
Right. You also were talking about snipes a while ago.
Uh-huh.
And my brother-in-law, and his one of his other brother-in-law, his only brother-in-law, his other brother-in-law. But anyway, probably 30 or maybe 40-odd years ago, they're avid duck hunters, and they shoot the occasional quail, and they came across, I don't know if it was a snipe or a woodcock, they're similar birds, but they killed a bunch of them when they were boys anyway.
Uh-huh.
And they were in a cutover, and they migrate through here in the creek bottoms.
Yep. Yeah. And the woodcock are in a different habitat setting than the snipe. You would not see those two shoulder to shoulder. So snipe are going to be more in an open, wet field or a mud flat, something like that. A woodcock sounds a lot more like what you just described in a cutover area. And that's where you can find woodcock during the hunting season. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so I bet it was a woodcock.
That's the only time they ever killed any. But they are good eating, just like a quail.
Yeah, and they're difficult. There are not many woodcock hunters out there because it's hard to find them. They're in what we call ephemeral habitats, meaning after a few years of growth, they get out of that plant succession that's favorable to them. So you constantly have to scout, and then you need a bird dog. They're about like quail, where you've got to have a dog to alert you. Otherwise, if you're just walking, they flush so quick you cannot get ready to pull the trigger. And then another thing about snipe, they're in these cutover areas, like you mentioned, and they're often covered in brambles and thorns, and you can lose a lot of blood and tear up a lot of clothing on a woodcock hunt. So they're right. Certainly a challenge.
Well, like I say, it's 30 or 40 years ago that this happened. They'll probably never kill another one. I know my brother-in-law won't, because he since passed away. But I don't know when they'll ever see any more in this part of the country. But they may pass through much more often than I suspect. But you've got to catch a cutover just right in the near the creek bottom.
Right, right. Yeah, that sounds good. Okay, Steve, well, thank you for the call.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And, well, we have a full bank of calls right now, Cliff, so we're going to get to our next one. Leon from Bossier City. Leon, what's your question for Cliff tonight?
Question is about geese in Bossier City. Okay. Along the parkway in Bossier, I have seen two different gooses,
uh-huh.
types of geese.
Okay.
And I wondered, are they beginning to nest or stay over in our neck of the woods? I've seen mallards for the last two or three years kind of doing the same thing.
Right. Right. Well, it depends on the species. A lot of the geese that we see that stick around this far south to breed are usually domesticated or released. They might be free-flying and you think they're wild, but they had a different past that you're not aware of, where they came out of a cage and someone released them, or they escaped. But my guess is that those are not native waterfowl that you're seeing.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it was just kind of unusual. I'd not seen them before, and this year they're all over the place, it seems like.
Right, right. Right. Okay. Thank you, Leon.
Thank you. Wonderful show. Appreciate it.
All right. And thank you, Leon. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we still have just one line open, so please give it a few minutes and then go ahead and call in with your question right now. We're going to go next to Tony from Nacogdoches. Tony, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff. My question is about Phoebe. There's one that nests here every year in my carport, and the excuse me, I've got to turn off the radio because I'm driving myself crazy here.
Okay.
Anyway, the Phoebe has raised several nests full of eggs every year. Okay, I got the radio off. Now, what I noticed a couple of years ago was that it was making almost like trial nests. It was putting daubs of the same materials on the horizontal part of the roof. And it was anywhere from about 2 feet apart to about 2 inches apart. And I could not figure out what they were because it never made any effort to make them any bigger, but they were just, you know, maybe an inch, 2 inches across at the most. And it just made a whole line of them.
So you're saying it put just the basic foundation down and didn't finish the nest?
Yeah, it wasn't, I mean, it was just a little wad of stuff.
Maybe it would have
started a nest, but I don't know. I can't think that it was stupid enough to start one on the horizontal ledge.
Right, so I don't know what's going on. Usually they make a pretty good decision, and once they start, they don't finish until it's done. But it sounds like your bird maybe had second thoughts multiple times. I don't know what did that.
I'm glad to know that it's not just something obvious because I was totally mystified by it. But it's been very regular, and amazingly, it doesn't seem to mind my car or my cat or anything else. Because I try to bring the car in far enough that the cat can't climb up on the roof and jump at it.
Another option, Tony, is that maybe your bird is unmated and it's not really doing the full cycle. It's maybe starting a nest and it needs a mate to really get things going. So you might look to see if there's more than one bird involved. But Phoebes do really well. They nest under bridges, like you said, under porches, carports. And they're doing quite well. For those that aren't aware, the Eastern Phoebe is a little flycatcher that wags its tail. And so they're pretty bland looking, but they flick their tail like a dog wagging its tail. And so it's ever so slightly, but if you watch it enough, you won't see another bird in the yard doing that kind of behavior. But they're great neighbors to have, Tony, and I hope you realize that they eat a lot of flies and a lot of other pesky aerial insects. So the Phoebe is a great neighbor to have.
I just like them because they raise several, I would call them litters, because I'm more into like mammals. But I don't know. I can't remember what you call them.
Clutches.
Fledges. They raise several fledges a year, and I don't know for certain that it's the same bird, but it's in the same nest, and of course they all look kind of alike to me, but it's just a delightful bird. It's nice to have it there year after year.
Yeah, so the analogous term to litters is clutches.
Oh, clutches, I'm sorry, yes.
Clutches,
fledges.
Yeah. So,
I should have known that.
That's fine. Yeah, that's good. Well, that's a great species to have as your neighbor, Tony. And thanks for the call about the Eastern Phoebe.
Yeah, thanks a lot for letting me know what was going on.
Great.
Talk to you later.
You bet.
Bye.
Yep. Bye-bye.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, from Red River Radio. We invite you to call in tonight with your questions about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have two lines open and do expect a bit of a wait. So please be patient with us as we're all working on remote locations and it's a bit cumbersome. So we hope you'll bear with us. Cliff, we go next to Rick from Shreveport. Rick, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
So I work at a store that's in a big shopping center. And a couple of times a year, I notice these flocks of birds that come in. And I think they're seagulls. I was wondering if that's possible.
Yeah, there are a lot of ringbill gulls that will winter in our area. And they like to come to dumpsters and clean up parking lots. So you might have seen some ringbill gulls. We have another gull that probably would never do that, and that's the Franklin's gull. That's a very common migrant in the listening area, but I've never heard them or seen them do anything like that. So if you're certain they were gulls, Rick, then I'm guessing they were ringbill gulls and it's a wintering thing. Do you remember what time of the year, what months of the year they were doing that?
Yeah, it was early spring.
Early spring. Yeah, it could have been some northbound ringbill gulls that were, you know, that had wintered on the Gulf Coast and they're headed north to the breeding grounds. So that's my guess. If we're certain they were gulls, then probably some ringbill gulls. There occasionally we'll get laughing gulls coming inland, very rarely though, and that's usually associated with a storm event, a tropical storm event. So it would take a hurricane or something in the warmer months or in the fall to bring laughing gulls up this far to Shreveport, at least that far inland. And that'd be a rare thing. And you'd notice it. You would see just a few in there. It would not be an annual thing at all. It might be something every 8 or 10 years, something of that frequency.
I'll try to get a picture next time, maybe send to you.
Yeah, that would be the great way to do it. But that's not, you know, I don't see a whole lot of ringbill gulls doing that. I've seen them flying over parking lots, especially in Tyler, Texas. I've seen them in big numbers. So, but yeah, get a picture and call us back next year when you've secured a photo. That'd be great.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Rick.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we remind you, if you do have a photo of a bird you'd like Cliff to identify, you can send it to my email address at wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's wbeckett, B-E-C-K-E-T-T, at lsus.edu. And we have two callers online right now. We're going to go to Shelby from Nacogdoches. Shelby, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, it's nice to talk to you. I was wanting to put up an owl box in my yard. Are there any specifications that you would recommend for it?
Well, I'd first try to figure out which owl you're targeting. In your area, there's two species that would use a box, and they're very different in size. So the barred owl is a cavity nester, and so they like old hollows and trees, and they'll sometimes use a box. But it would need to be almost the size of a dorm refrigerator. So that's a big box. And I did it once. I built one. I had to hire a tree trimming buddy that can get up in the tree to put it up at 34 feet. We had to put up pulleys and ropes, and it was a mess, but it worked until a raccoon kicked out the barred owl and used it for himself. So there are a lot of other species that are looking for the same free real estate, the free government housing, so to speak. And the second owl is the eastern screech owl. And that's a bird that a lot of people put boxes up, and you can look for blueprints on the internet or look for someone who sells those, like Wild Birds Unlimited sell screech owl boxes, and you can put one of those up and try to attract a screech owl. They're usually in your more upland settings, like drier, higher drier pine hardwood forests, whereas the barred owl that I mentioned earlier, they're more in your creek bottom habitat or lake's edge, somewhere more of a pure hardwood bottomland type setting. So that really matters. Your yard, what kind of setting are you in? And then number two, what species are you trying to target? And then also you want to make sure that the worlds collide. In other words, if you're in a bottomland setting, you might not get a screech owl, or the opposite. If you're in a very high, dry upland setting, you might not get a barred owl. So have you thought about which owl you're trying to target, Shelby?
I've heard some barred owls, so I'd most likely go for them.
Yeah, so that's a lot of fun to do, but again, it's a lot of work. I've seen there's some, where I got inspired on the box for that one, I looked up somewhere in North Carolina, there was somebody putting up boxes for those in an urban city, I don't remember which city in North Carolina, and they had cameras, and it was really cool. And I was, my family and I were so happy when several weeks after we put it up, a barred owl was in it, in the box, sitting in the entrance. I have pictures. I took video. We had neighbors come by. I set up a scope at a safe distance away, and we had lots of people lining up to see the owl sitting in there. Some of them thought it was fake, that it was a joke, but once it moved or blinked its eyes, they're like, oh my gosh, that's real. So it can be pretty exhilarating to accomplish that. So Shelby, you've got a good little homework assignment, and I hope it works out.
What would be the best time of year to put it up?
They're already using a cavity right now, so you wouldn't capture this breeding season. But the rule of thumb is if you get it up, the sooner you get it up, the sooner they will find it. So the two species of owl I mentioned are year-round residents. And so they don't leave the area, and you're not going to be attracting a bird from Manitoba, Canada, if you put up a box. The bird's already there, but if he's already noticed it and mapped it and remembers it for when he needs it, the sooner you get it up, the better that he can map it and find it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Shelby.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And from Red River Radio, and we invite you to call in tonight with your questions at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have two callers online. Karen, please hold on for a second, and we're going to go next to Josh from Nacogdoches. Josh, what's your question tonight?
Hey, Cliff, how you doing?
Hey, good, Josh.
Good. I keep chickens and ducks in an open, free-range kind of situation. And this morning, I saw two black vultures. They have built a nest right over their feeding area.
Huh.
And I wondered if that was going to be a problem, or is it a good thing, or what?
Wow. Did they already lay an egg?
I haven't seen any eggs. The nest is brand new. I mean, it wasn't there 2 days ago, but it's a big one already.
Wow. Well, you know, vultures don't really add a whole lot. What do you mean by nest? Are they putting vegetation down, leaves and sticks?
Yeah, it's just a bunch of big, coarse kind of pine sticks about 25, 30 feet up in a tree.
That does not sound like a vulture. The black vulture and the turkey vulture typically nest on the ground, or in an old building, an abandoned barn, for example.
Okay.
And they'll sometimes, if they don't lay the eggs on the ground, they'll lay it on the up in the attic of an open facility, an open building. But I don't know what you're seeing, because they typically don't use old raptor nests, and they don't build their own nests. So I don't know what you're seeing, Josh. It does not sound like a vulture. Can you take a picture and can you make sure it's actually using the nest, or is it just coincidentally sitting by an old hawk nest, for example?
That's the thing. I didn't see it. I just saw both of them fly out of that tree when I went down there to feed this morning.
Yeah, it could be attracted to the smell of the chicken poo, and they could be checking it out. The good thing is vultures aren't going to get in there. They're not true raptors with powerful feet to take chickens and ducks, but they might be attracted to the poo smell. So you might work on that a little bit, but they may be maybe it was just coincidental that they were there, but I have a feeling it was very coincidental that they were next to a stick nest, because that was not their nest.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Josh.
All right, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford from Red River Radio. And we do have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we go to Karen from somewhere in Texas next. Hi, Karen. And what part of Texas do you hail from?
I'm from Trinity County, Texas. I'm quarantining over here. I normally live in San Antonio. And we were on a Zoom call with our family, with our son and granddaughter. We're out on the porch the other evening, and I heard a whippoorwill in the woods on the other side of the pasture. And I asked my granddaughter if she'd ever heard one, and she couldn't hear it. So I pulled one up on my phone, the sound of it, and played it. And then the whippoorwill came and got in this big old sycamore tree right next to our house. It was attracted to the calls on, you know, I was listening to on my phone. And it was so loud. We were so astonished. And then the next night I was sitting out and it came again. And I'd never heard it in that so close to the house before. And now that's I feel like I've led it astray and I feel bad.
Well, yeah, you want to do that in small bursts. And so I would say you conquered it and I wouldn't do it again.
I'm not doing it anymore.
Yeah, now I'm a little surprised that you're still finding whippoorwills this late in migration. Are you certain it was not a Chuckwill's widow?
It's a whippoorwill. I'm very sure. We've always had one for years down the lane at my great grandmother's house. It was always in the same place, but now there are three around the house. Over in the woods next, just beyond the pasture that I hear at night.
Okay, let's listen to this one. Play that, Troy or Bill, play that louder. Is that your bird, Karen?
I think that sounds like it. I listened to Chuckwill. I had listened to the difference between the two, but I'm pretty sure it's a whippoorwill.
Okay, well, I'm not. I'm going to disagree with you that this late in the this late in the season there should be no whippoorwills in Trinity County. So you're one county from me. I know that area. You're probably near Kennard or Apple Springs, so I know that area really well. And there should not be a whippoorwill in middle of May. That's getting pretty late. So I would double check. The chuck is supposed to be there. Yeah.
Okay. I have one more quick question. Yesterday, my husband thinks he saw an albino mockingbird. Is there such a thing?
There have been plenty of records of that. And so I'm trying to think what else could be on that chassis that's all white. I'm not thinking of anything. So there was one. I mentioned it on air before. There was one that, when La Hacienda was around in Nacogdoches, that's a restaurant that's no longer a restaurant. There was an albino mockingbird there. It's probably been 25, 30 years ago. But that's not unheard of, Karen. There could be one. And I'd say try to get a picture and send it to us. Maybe that's something we can put on the webpage and show other people, because that's pretty neat.
Well, I also got a video of the Jaguarundi.
Oh, now that one, I'm never going to believe you on that one.
I have two videos of it. And you can see the long tail, black, and weighed about 30 pounds.
If you were in Mexico and you filmed it, I would believe you. But if you filmed it in Trinity County, there's no way that was a Jaguarundi. No.
Okay. I'll send you my videos.
Yeah,
send us the video. Absolutely,
you send the video to me, and I will look at your cat that you have found—a feral cat. But there are no Jaguarundis in Texas, north of a. Well, actually, you talk to the cat experts, and there hasn't been an official Jaguarundi record in Texas since about 1981.
There's a lot of anecdotal sightings. There was a woman in Nacogdoches who saw it was up on her porch.
Yeah, and that was bogus. That, I mean, that's ridiculous. I remember that, and there's no way, if you're going to have a Jagrundi, it's not going to be on your darn porch. So there's another possibility, and that's people are misidentifying what they're seeing. And so there is no way you've got a Jagrundi. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, Karen. Thank you for the call.
Videos. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yep. Yep.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we're getting close to the end of the show. We do have two callers online. Brad from Longview, you're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Over Christmas, we were giving two bat houses, and it came with instructions. The problem I'm finding is that I really don't have a place to put them. I live in the city limits, but I'm surrounded by woods. I have a creek, trees all around us. I don't know if it's okay to put it high up on a tree. You know, I maybe could hire, like you said, a tree trimming guy to help me, but I don't know where to put it, but we are ate up with mosquitoes.
Well, the bat house, you've got like a 1% chance of 1%, 1% of 1% chance of getting bats to come to a bat house. I'll just tell you right now, the chances are slim. That stat is going to be off. I'm just throwing out that it's super, super hard and almost impossible to get a bat to come to a house. So I'd stick it up there. Prove me wrong. I'm fine to be wrong. But chances are you're not going to get a bat, no matter where you put it, in the city, in the country, high or low, I don't care. But prove me wrong. But put it up just wherever and hope for the best. But, you know, unless you're in places where things like Brazilian free-tailed bats are common, there's just not a lot of colonial bats that are going to use a bat box. So,
We've seen sightings. We have a pool in the backyard, and every summer, it seems like it's late summer, we see them around dusk. We'll see them in the air.
You'll see evening bats. You'll see maybe tricolored bat. And some of those, like the evening bat, are more solitary nesters. Things like the red bat, they're a solitary nester. They don't get into big colonies or groups. So the bats you're seeing are more than likely singles that roost separately. They're not colonial. So they're not going to get into a box.
Okay. Well, since it was a gift, I'll try anyway and try to prove you wrong.
Yeah, I mean, you might as well. So something else might get into them, maybe some wasp or something else. And some of the, you know, those might be good for being pollinators or controlling insects themselves. So,
sure. All right, Brad. I did see something real quick. I did see something real interesting. I've always wanted to. I'm an oil field pumper. I was going down a lease road, and just as I got to the road, a hawk grabbed a snake and flew off with it. It was so cool. I wish I had caught it on my camera.
That's awesome. That's a great wildlife moment that you got to see that. So very cool.
Yeah, it was cool. Thanks for taking my call, Cliff.
Yeah, thank you, Brad.
All right, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We've got two callers online, so we're going to ask that you just state your question, and then Cliff will answer briefly because we have to get to our conservation tip. WD, we're not sure where you're from, so please ask your question of Cliff.
Yes, sir. You had mentioned talking about roadrunners. I have one in my backyard occasionally. And what do they eat, and is there anything I can do to make it more attractive for him to stay in the yard?
Yeah, they eat lizards, snakes, and large grasshoppers. Those are three of the biggies. So if you want to try to propagate any of those and then release them, but otherwise Mother Nature's probably doing the best job at providing food for roadrunners. So, yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you, WD.
All right. And we go next to Charles from Shreveport. Charles, you're our final caller today. What's your question?
Okay, well, I did not know that Baltimore Orioles were found in Shreveport, but for the last 2 weeks, I've had them coming to my hummingbird feeder.
Yeah, and that's one reason we probably told a previous caller, previous episodes, to get an Oriole feeder, because what happens is that heavy, big, bulky, heavy Oriole will sit on a hummingbird feeder, tilt it, and boom, they spill a lot of that nectar. So you can fix that by getting an Oriole feeder. It's the same thing. It's nectar. It's just built to support the Oriole so the stuff doesn't spill out.
Yeah, well, I don't have that much of a problem with them tilting it and spilling it out. No. I've had a couple of them fight to get to it.
Yeah.
And are the females kind of a yellow-orange color? Because I see that a lot, too.
Right. The males are bright orange and black, and the females are yellowy. So, yeah, but if they get to be a problem, look up an oriole feeder, order one, and boom, there you go.
I was just totally blown away that looking out in the backyard, and I was like, no way.
That's pretty cool. Well, thank you for the call, Charles. Thank you very much.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls, or have been listening to Bird Calls, from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And as always, Cliff, we close out with a conservation tip. What do you have for us this month?
So do you ever wonder what's on your property when you're not looking? I'm not talking about trespassers or burglars, but other critters living alongside you. Consider setting out a game camera, or game cam, also known as a trail camera. You can point the camera at something in your yard that attracts wildlife, like a bird feeder or water feature. Our urban backyard camera has captured excellent images of a variety of critters, from a summer tanager to a red fox. There are several types of these cameras available at varying prices, several good ones at under $150. Some of the better units require a data plan, because they'll automatically text you photos that were just snapped. This is a great option for the absentee landowner or for those who travel a lot. Be sure to get a camera that can take photos at night, because you'll be amazed at what visits your property after the sun has long set. Whether it's daytime or nighttime photos, your pictures will accumulate quickly and can be a lot of fun to review, organize, save, and share with family and friends. Our camera will snap at anything finch-sized or larger, but this all depends on the distance the sensor is from the target. Many game cameras have trouble capturing images of tiny, flat, fast-flying critters, so don't expect a lot of hummingbird or dragonfly photos. Keep a list of what your camera documents and be proud that you're sharing the land with other species. Do it for the birds.
All right. Thank you, Cliff. And you have been listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and the state ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everyone at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this program. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Our producers are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with technical assistance tonight, can't say that word, from Troy Jones, and phone bank assistance from Wally Derleth. The sound files used in tonight's programs and our profile species were from xenocanto.org and were recorded by Peter Bozeman. This month's bird photo of bird on the Bird Calls page was snapped by James Childress. The audio for tonight's program will be posted to our website in a couple of hours. And remember, if you have a photo or sound clip of a bird that you would like Cliff to identify, please send it to my email address at wbeckett@lsus.edu. wbeckett@lsus.edu. Please join us for the next installment of Bird Calls on June 9th. And we ask you to join us next Tuesday at 6 p.m. for What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden. This is Red River Radio, your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS.